Okay, if we go ahead and close the doors in the back, please. We have a full house, which is great. Sorry for the 5-minute delay. They put the bathrooms all the way on the opposite side, so it's a long madman's dash back and forth to use a bathroom. So let me just find the clicker and we will get started. Thanks. Okay. Alrighty, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to attend my session. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Tony Sanchez. I'm with Citrix Systems. I work on a team that's called the Worldwide Strategic Alliances. And basically what I do is I have the fun job of building the architecture between Citrix and Microsoft. Some of the things I focus on are Windows Zen Desktop version 7, 5.6, the whole nine yards. But I had the kind of cool thing to figure out how does it work and how does it scale and how does it break. That's effectively what I get to do in my day-to-day job. But today I'm going to show you something that's kind of different than what I normally do. And we're going to go into some different designs that may be helpful for those of you that are current Citrix customers and are looking to go to Zen Desktop 7. So let's go over the session agenda. Here's what we're going to cover. We're going to go over all the different sorts of architectures that are available in version 7. By show of hands, how many of you are current Citrix customers? Brilliant. All right, this is going to be really easy. How many of you currently have implemented already version 7 in production? All right, for those of you that haven't, you're in for a ride. You're going to learn a lot of information, a lot of different designs, and it's going to be really helpful information as you plan your migration to version 7. I have a ton of equipment up here, probably at least 6 different laptops. So you're going to see a ton of demos. And I promise to only have 2 slides that are marketing. That's it. Everything else, pure technical, and you're going to love it. It's going to be good stuff. At the very end, we're going to show some future code, some demos that I also have prepared that I've got approval to show you that are things that are possible, things that are in the hopper that we're looking at Citrix. So there'll be some really interesting things I think you'll like. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. In terms of, for those of you that are not familiar with Citrix and Microsoft, where we are and where we have been, it's pretty obvious here. We're our market leader in terms of VDI. We've been around for quite a long time. And throughout all these years, we've always partnered tightly with Microsoft, whether it's the OS layer, whether it's the application virtualization stack, specifically AppV, or whether it's even things like profiling with UEV or our own profiling manager. The ability for you to take both of those architectures on your terms and you decide which one's best are things that we fully support in each one of our designs, whether it's, like I said, UEV or profiling, whether it's Windows 7, Windows 8, and now for those of you that are looking at the newest stuff, Windows 8.1, we support all of that. But what's nice about it is we've done more than just deliver desktops, because that's a no-brainer. Anybody can do that now. We've gone to the next level where we're doing more than just that, where we're using user-centric device affinity, things that we can integrate with a system center stack that makes it really more special and more unique than just a plain Jane desktop. In terms of what we've been and where we are currently, this is pretty interesting. A lot of people still think of Citrix as that one-trick pony from 20 years ago. Even now, 24 years ago, if you do the math. And we've changed since then. We don't just serve up terminal services. It's significantly different. So to take you on a little bit of a journey, let's see where we were started at. 1989 was the founding of Citrix. By show of hands, who knows, and I'll give you a prize, what was the original name of Citrix in 1989? Nope, that was a product. Very close, though. The original company name when we first started. Good. Hey, winner. Catch. Nice. So, yes, it was Citrix. That's what we were called 20-plus years ago. There's a big story behind that, but I won't go into that. It's quite interesting, though. If you want to look at the history, there's a guy that blogs on the whole start of the Citrix history from then to now. But over the years, lots has changed. Again, we don't just deliver that single protocol, that single terminal server. We've actually evolved a significant amount to the point where we started looking at things where we did acquisitions for companies, and we integrated things like NetScaler into our product line. So if you didn't know about that and you're new to it, if you go to Google, eBay, Amazon, a majority of these big companies use the NetScaler up front to optimize and load balance and speed up the performance. What's interesting, though, if you look at the bottom of this, you'll see Microsoft awards for Citrix. As far as I can tell, and this could have changed recently, but we won more ISV of the Year awards than any other partner in history. That's over 20 years we've been working with Microsoft. That's a pretty long time. If we keep building this out and we go to where we are now in 2013, lots and lots has changed. We're at the point now where we have Project Excalibur, which came out last October, which is now Zen Desktop 7, the final release of our product. And since then, a lot's changed. We support the latest and greatest Microsoft operating systems in version 7. And the idea behind version 7 was really for us to get to one console. If you're old school like me, I've sat in those same shoes you're in. I had a very large ZenApp farm that I administered before I came to Citrix. Actually, I had a farm over here in Australia as well. So I sat in those same seats you're in, dealt with the user calls day in and day out, printing, profiling, all those things that are common. And then as things went or got better, we've kind of figured out over the years from Citrix that it makes sense for us to combine the architectures. We need to truly get to one console because it's quite challenging for new customers to figure out which one do I choose, which is the right design for me. And that's where version 7 comes into play. And it's all about three key things. First off is mobility. If you're looking at a mobile device rollout, regardless whether it's Windows, iOS, even BlackBerry, if you're still going down that route, again, mobility is the number one most important thing at Citrix because we realize not everybody around here is going to take a laptop with them. And I'd probably say 75% of you all have a tablet that you're carrying. And the chances of you wanting to use that to connect to a remote application or desktop is pretty huge. So we think that is huge as well. Version 7 is also about simplicity. As we get further into the diagrams, you'll see how simple it is in terms of what we changed versus then to now, as well as secure. So let's go right into the architecture. That's all the marketing slides. We're going to get right into the bits, and we're going to talk about all the good stuff that I love so much. If you're currently a ZenApp customer, by show of hands, who is using 4.x? A few. 5? 6.0? 6.5? All this stuff is a no-brainer to each of you then. You're all geniuses. You all know that each of these architectures are completely different. So if you look at the blocks are in orange, this is all current architecture for version 6.5 and some of its predecessors. You can still see we have the current requirements. You still have receiver on the endpoint. He still has to be there. He's not going away. He's just evolved and gotten better. You still have web interface. Again, if you're looking at current 6.5 code, that's the front end for users to get inside. But each of these consoles are where it gets really, well, ugly. It gets really difficult to figure out which is the right design for me to choose. If you look at the orange blocks again, you can see we have the delivery services console, you have Edge Site, you have PCM, which is Power Capacity Manager for draining your ZenApp servers on demand, and provisioning services. Each of these are all individual consoles that over the years became quite a pain in the butt for you to administer and figure out which is the right solution for me. Same thing applies over on the Zen Desktop side. On the right with the blue rectangles, you can see over there, we have this difference in terms of console, difference in terms of an agent, something called the VDA, or Virtual Desktop Agent. If you also look at something really interesting, both of these architectures have a separate SQL database every single time. If you look at ZenApp 6.5, you need a SQL database for Edge Site, for Power Capacity Manager, for PVS, for just about everything. Same thing applies for Zen Desktop 5.6. Even though we tried to make it better, and we leveraged something called FMA, which is FlexCast Management Architecture, guess what? You still need SQL and a separate database. It could be the same server, different instance. It's up to you to do that, but you still need separate databases. So that's where things change from then to now in version 7. Version 7 is completely different in the fact that we've unified a majority of what was a separate entity in terms of console and in terms of a database. You can see here, we still have receiver there at the front, still a requirement. However, web interface, gone. Not a part of the architecture. Storefront is a replacement for web interface, so if you haven't used Storefront, it is a feature you can use in version 7, and also existed previously as a separate download as opposed to using web interface. But if you notice something, whether you're talking virtual desktops, whether they're server OSs or client OSs, what do you see that merged there? The SQL database. One database for any architecture. You choose which is the right one based upon your design, but for us, we don't care. We just want to make it easier for you to design it. Studio is still the important front end part. If you see there in the diagram, that's your interface. That is your canvas if you consider yourself to be like a VDI artist. That's where you design everything and paint your entire infrastructure from, is from Studio. And then director, which is a separate thing for using performance monitoring metrics. That's one of the things we won't get into in this session, but if you want to have, you know, a deeper discussion, we can definitely talk afterwards. So what have we done that's made it much simpler? First off, FlexCast has made a big difference in here. We've actually made it simpler so that you can use VDI and RDSH workloads within that same architecture if you want to go down that route. Remote PC, probably one of the best kept hidden secrets of Zen Desktop. If you don't have a hypervisor or you're trying to figure out the way to get the simplest way to get remote access to a desktop, remote PC is the easiest way. If you have a PC in your cubicle, a laptop, something that you want to get to remotely, but you don't want to go through the pain of creating a hypervisor and management, remote PC is the way to go. So you put the virtual agent on there, make a connection from the broker, you're in. It's the fastest way to a virtual desktop infrastructure with less stress. And it works on just about any physical device, Blade PC, you name it. Local app access, we'll get into that. That is a super, super cool thing. I want to show you. I've got a great demo on that. I think you'll like it a lot. Wizards are definitely better. If you've installed version 7, the average installation time, at least I've seen, whether it's using, you know, HP Gen 8 Blades, whatever they may be, 15 minutes tops. If it takes longer than 15, you got a hardware problem. But the installation is pretty quick. The other thing that makes it install slower is SQL Express. So if you have a SQL database in production, use it. It works great. If you want to do something simple, like a proof of concept, just know it's going to take an extra 5+ minutes to install SQL Express. In terms of all the merging of data, apps, and OS, profiling, personal VDisk, storefront, that's all also integrated within the same UI within Studio. Of course, version 7, we support Windows 8 and Server 2012. Same thing for our Server 2012 with Hyper-V and System Center VMM with Service Pack 1. So all that is supported out the gate with version 7. HDX Insight is something also you may want to get into. If you're concerned about the user experience coming from an endpoint, going through something like a Netscaler, and wanting to figure out, well, really, is it truly within the infra, or is it outside the infrastructure at that user level or at the web level? That's where you would look into getting that sort of data and metrics from. All right, with that, let's go into more of the architecture of version 7. So this is where it's going to be interesting for those of you that are old school Zen app admins like me. Learning version 7 is a little bit different because you have to think outside the box. You can't just go and apply the same exact logic as version 4 or version 5 because it is significantly different. So first off, the concept of controllers is here. Controller is that most important part of the architecture, that traffic cop who's responsible for dictating which desktop you go to, which app you go to, how do you log in. That is the main purpose of controller. And controller can work on any one of these operating systems, whether it's Server 2000R2 or Windows 2012. The worker is probably the other thing that really is interesting that we did in version 7. If you look at these pictures here, think of that big Air 380 bus as RDS. Multiple users, one machine, or one physical box. And the jets are a little bit different. That's more your VDI route. Super fast desktops, more of a one-to-one relationship. That sort of setup is what makes version 7 unique, because workers are where we actually are going to make the connection to, whether it's a server OS or whether it's a client OS. In terms of the management, we still have the two key interfaces. You still have Studio for building, but then you have Director for monitoring, as I stated before. But the concept of catalogs and groups is really important. I stress you have to really learn this, especially if you're old school Zen app, because it's different. It can be confusing if you don't think about it logically. The way I like to best explain it is if you think about catalogs as an OU, an Active Directory, you can't have an empty OU without objects inside of it. It has to be a machine object, a user object. That relationship is the marriage between catalogs and groups in Zen Desktop. A catalog is at the top. Inside that catalog is the group. And that group contains the objects like the client machines, server machines, and so forth that you're going to connect into. In terms of the interface, again, Studio is the only thing you really truly need to use. If you're familiar with the old school version of publishing apps in ZenApp, don't need to worry about that because that's changed in version 7. It's completely different in terms of publishing that and getting through the process of making desktops and apps. So let's go into our first demo. Give me just a second while I switch over to the screen. Okay, can everybody see my Lumberg? All right. Great. Love Lumberg, heck of a guy. I'm glad I don't have a boss like that, though. Drive me nuts. All right, so let's take a look. For those of you who have not seen it, again, this is a version 7 studio interface. Now you can see I've done my homework. I've already prepped a bunch of infrastructure role VMs. I've created my catalogs, which you see right there, and each of these are kind of tailored to specific workloads. And you may say to yourself, well, I've got all these different OSs. That's great. You can do it that way. You can create catalogs in sort of an OS relationship. You may have catalogs for Windows XP, catalogs for Windows 8, catalogs for Windows 2012, and marry those to the groups. So that's kind of what we have set up here. So I've got a bunch of different catalogs. I've got Windows 7. I've got an All Blacks catalog for the Haka when we get, you know, feeling a little jiggy, we want to do that dance. Same thing for Server 2008 R2. So conceptually, if I wanted to create one, this is what the process is like. We start by creating a machine catalog. So I'm going to go ahead and do this on my demonstration system here. It's a little bit slow. Bear with me. It's one laptop that's fully pegged with 32 gig of RAM, but there's a ton of VMs running on here. So my first step is going to ask me, what do I want to do? Well, I'm going to go ahead and create a manual setup, and I'm going to select my role. Now, going back to that diagram, remember we can do server OSs, client OSs. These are the functions you're going to choose during the catalog, depending upon that business pain you're trying to solve. Is it an app problem? Is it an OS problem? These are things that we'll get into further more in the design. So I'm going to check desktop OS. The next thing it's going to ask me is, what do you want to do? Now, because we can do this in a variety of ways, remember I mentioned remote PC is one of those ways I can connect to a physical machine. I have that choice within the version 7 UI, within Studio. I also have two choices down here. For those of you that are fairly new, that are ZenApp administrators, and you're not familiar with MCS or PBS, the simplest way to explain this is MCS requires a hypervisor. PBS does not. You can stream PBS to bare metal machines, or you can do it at a hypervisor. Both have different use cases, but primarily, if you're looking for quick snapshot technology, sort of like you would a VM in Hyper-V, that's conceptually what MCS is like. Fast way to deploy a desktop, however, it's a hypervisor VDI-only route. So click Next here, and obviously I have options here for PBD for personalization, but that'll take a little bit longer. So I'm just gonna go ahead and say assign a random desktop. I'll select my resource here. Here's my Hyper-V host. And once this talks, it's going to actually go to VMM. It's going to say, hey, enumerate all the machines or VMM templates I see that are available for me to leverage as part of my snapshotting technology for machine creation services, or MCS. I'll select my master image here. Click Next. It's going to ask me how many I want to create, the amount of RAM, and so forth. An interesting thing to note here, if you're a Hyper-V customer, by a show of hands, how many of you guys use Hyper-V right now in terms of the enterprise? Something interesting here, you'll see that you don't see the option for dynamic memory. So that is one thing you may want to consider. If dynamic memory is a key architecture choice, provisioning services does have that function in there for the first release of Zen Desktop 7. So basically, I would select how much I want. I click Next, select an OU, and I'll scroll down a little bit, and let's just put it in desktops, and I'll call it Tech Ed Test. And then I give it a name. Now, normally I click Finish, but what's going to happen, I'm going to click Cancel because that's going to super peg my little laptop here and crush everything else I have running, and I want to make sure I show you all the future demos. So I would click Finish. Normally what happened is the PowerShell scripting would occur, and we go through the process of talking to the middleman, which is VMM in this case, send all the jobs to Hyper-V, spawn the desktops, and create them. And you would see here, I have one already created. This would be the end result. So I've created my catalog. The next thing to do would create my group. Remember that marriage. You have to have the catalog. Inside the catalog, you have the group. So click Group, select Next, and it only will enumerate what I've already created. If I didn't create a catalog that's unavailable, I can't use it. It only shows me the options that I have to choose from. So here I'll show this one. I'll select AB Haka Win 7 Desktop. I'll say I want one of them. Click Next. And here's the interesting part, and this is part of that integration of thinking Zen App and Zen Desktop. I can choose to do apps or desktops, even though it's a Windows 7 client operating system. So we have a design choice we'll get further into to explain it a little bit more. I click Next at this part, add some users, say Tony, click OK. Next, assign my storefront site for where users are going to log into. And then last, give it a name. And then we click Finish. So So now we're going to go ahead and create the group. Everything gets done in Studio. And then when all is said and done, we basically have a desktop that we can log into that's already provisioned from Studio UI. So let's go over here, and we will actually do a demonstration of that. Give me 1 second while we switch over here to input 3. Okay, can you guys see this okay? All right, great. I'm gonna jump out of this real fast, and we'll refresh here. So you can already see I already have Provision 1. That's a Windows 8 desktop. So I can go through here, and I already had that connected, but we'll go ahead and reconnect to it again. And that's the Windows 8 desktop. So let's see what happens. One of the things that you'll see in version 7 that we've greatly enhanced is the H.264 experience in terms of the codec that we use. Now, this is on my machine, so it's going to be a little busy. And we'll go ahead and let that play. But you can see H.264 makes a big difference. And now this is an iPad also, so it's wireless. If I injected latency into the equation, which I did earlier in a demo, that also makes a big impact as well. Great game, I watched that last night. So I'm getting familiar with rugby, so it's actually really, really, really interesting stuff to learn. So that's a big thing. So if you're looking at mobility, you have to figure out what's the right protocol I need for the right device. And H.264 does a big, big difference from where we had thin wire protocol as part of our protocol stream for our virtual channels before. So that is a special thing that only Citrix provides for multiple devices. All right, so let's go back to our PowerPoint. All right, so that concludes our first design. Let's go to our second design, which is what we already did here. In each of those desktops I created, you saw in that UI, I could have picked either one of these. I could have picked pooled, static, random, dedicated, remote PC. These are all choices that I did. So I already did this demo for you just to show you what it was like, but we're going to go ahead and skip that one and go to the next design. By show of hands, how many use SCCM 2012 in your production? A good fair amount of you, okay. And I'm sure many of you know this, but it's surprising how many times I get people that don't know this, that you can use SCCM to deliver apps to Zenapp 6.5. A lot of people still don't know that. It's one of the best kept secrets if you have SCCM. So let's talk about some of the use cases for that and why it makes sense. So if you have a big enterprise and you're a Zenapp administrator and you're working with your System Center team, and case in point, when I was administrator, I didn't really know who they were. The guys that made these apps appear on my desktop, I just knew I had to make them work on my Zenapp server. There's this great opportunity for you to cross-collaborate between both teams and for you to offload some of the most simplest things. Let's say you go on a holiday and you really don't have a backup, but you want this guy to be able to publish applications from the Configuration Manager console to your Zenapp servers. You can simply do that with, at the same time, not giving him full farm admin rights. So it's pretty impressive that you can do that. So it can really be a single pane of glass. If you're familiar with it, this might be a little bit of a refresher, but for those of you that are not, we'll go through a couple slides and we'll showcase a demonstration of what that's like. So what does it do for you? Four simple things. First off, it unifies the deployment cycle of apps because we can take those apps and put them in either scenario, whether it's Zenapp servers, whether it's even endpoints, because SCCM 2012 really follows something different about user device affinity. The whole concept of just saying, hey, you're going to log in this machine, this is everything you're going to get, that's out the door with 2012. You can pick and choose based upon the rules if it's a primary PC, if it's not a primary PC. Those are some of the things that we can do and integrate with a connector. Of course, we can deliver to any device. That's the cool part. So any app you want to deliver, whether it's a Windows device or not, even if it's iOS, we can tag and deliver it with a connector. But what about App B? Another great solution if you want to integrate the two. So if you have App B in the environment, but you don't really have a whole infrastructure, maybe you have some packages, this is another way you can take those same packages and recycle them, import them into your SCCM server, and then leverage those for your Zenapp infrastructure. So the concept would go like this. Let's say you're the administrator on the SCCM side. You would go through this process of importing your app v DT or deployment type package. And then that package then gets delivered to the Zenapp server farm via PowerShell. And effectively, the user has that deployment type option for them to launch that package from the iOS device or Windows device, whatever they choose. Let's go over some of the logic, some of the Boolean query rules on how this really, really works. So after I've created my deployment types, let's look at what this has to happen in terms of each of these rules. Let's say I have a machine, and let's say it's a thin client. It's got less than 512 meg of RAM. Not probably the best design for me to take a whole 4 gig APB package and deliver it to that thin client. It's probably not going to work. So the best idea would be to deliver it to ZenApp. Now, what if I had another machine, and let's say it was a machine that I log into frequently. It has a hard disk that's greater than 40 gig. I can still take that same APB package and actually execute it on that machine as opposed to ZenApp, simply just by following some rules and conditions that we have set up in a CCM. But it gets more interesting. What if it's a primary device that I use that's assigned to me from my SCCM administrator? I log in all day long. I can also leverage a deployment type that has an MSI flavor. Totally fine. Either one of these we can use in either situation or either architecture. Here's how the administrator goes to deploying it. First off, you create your package as normal. You take that deployment type, and the unique thing here is you target it to your ZenApp servers. You don't just target it to, you know, a couple of machines. You have to be a little bit intelligent. So this is where the fun part comes in. You target it to your ZenApp server, and you also target it to your users. Because you want to have some logic that says, well, if this user's coming in and it's a machine that's a ZenApp server their credentials are logging into, let's run that application there. And here's how the workflow goes. Kind of just like before, we go to the console, we provision the application that's an MSI package per se. The deployment type parameters from the SCCM server then get pushed to each of the ZenApp servers in an orchestrated mode. So let's say it's maintenance between 2 in the morning and 6 in the morning. That intelligence kicks in to say, okay, this is the right time for me to push a 10 gig APB sequence series of packages. Once that's done, we then take those and deliver them to the ZenApp controller. So that automation occurs all under the covers. You never see it happen because it's all done via PowerShell. So it's pretty impressive once you have that done. And the end result is that user gets the ability for them to read that document or leverage that application on that device. And so it's pretty simple. But what if using provisioning services? Doesn't matter. Same thing applies. You can actually leverage your common ZenApp master image, insert the SCCM agent process in here, apply those particular OS updates or packages that you need, and then go through the same process of letting the agent orchestrate when's the right time to reboot or put those servers in maintenance, and then push out the applications to the ZenApp server. So exact same process applies, except you have a little bit of extra work if you're using provisioning services because you have to update your master image. So let's see what that looks like from a demo. We're going to jump back over to our machine over here. Not yet. Let's try one more time. Nope. Hold on a second, guys. We'll get this working here. Input B, cut. There we go. All right. So let's jump out of this box and let's go over to our SCCM server, which we have right here. So what I've done is I've already pre-populated some packages in here, but I'll just kind of show you what this looks like. There are some extensions you have to have in order to make this work. It's not just you can install a product and magically SCCM work with ZenApp. It's not quite that simple. You have to install some agents, and what those agents do is extend the console here. So you have ZenApp Publications, which is a node within the SCCM console. Once you have that portion done, and you also have some client agents that go on your endpoints or your ZenApp servers, you then have the ability to go ahead and publish applications from here to your farm. So let's go and see what that looks like. Remember earlier I said you have to have a combination of deployment types and deployments. So here you can see I have a deployment type for Mathematics that's already targeted to ZenApp. So it's already been pushed from here to the ZenApp server. And I also have some deployments that are tied to my farm and my users. We're going to use XML Notepad as our example here to make a new deployment type. Because right now I have an APB deployment, but what I really want to do is push this out to the ZenApp server. So I'll create a deployment type here. And once that window pops up, it's going to ask me, what do you want to do? I go to the bottom and select 6.5. Now, I'll pause here for a second. What you're seeing here is version 6.5. We are working on a release for Zen Desktop 7. So that's in the hopper, soon to come. If you're looking at going version 7, trying to do all this, this function here, the connector, is only applicable for 6.5. We'll select next. We'll give it a name so we know it's something different. We'll call it dash ZenApp. And here, we'll go ahead and click new. What we want to actually do is make sure we publish the application correctly. This part looks exactly the same for current administrators of ZenApp. it's almost identical. You can see here the name displays like this. We'll call this one also ZenApp. We're going to publish it to this particular folder on our server. We'll select if it's an AppV5 sequence app, which in this case it is. We can see our package GUID, so we know it's unique and that it can't conflict. We can add a shortcut to the desktop and click Finish. The next part then is just a summary. And at this point, SCECM is doing its job. It's making the agents go do a recheck, refresh, make sure everything's valid. And usually this takes about 3 to 5 minutes or maybe even longer. It all depends on what your sequencing is and what your maintenance windows are like. So while this is going through this process, we're going to wait just another minute, and then I'm going to force what's called a refresh manually so that I don't have to wait for this next 5 to 10 minutes for this application to appear. So while that's going, let's show you what we currently have that's already populated on our ZenApp server. So here's a 6.5 box I've got. I'm going to go ahead and log in. Here are those two applications already published. You can see they came across from that console, moved over to my ZenApp server. The whole API package was copied and literally pasted on this new ZenApp box. So I have this extension here, and you can see at all points that it's an installed application. It has a server it's pointed to, configured users, and so forth. So let's see actually if that process is done over from our configuration manager box. It says finished. That's great. Let's force a sequencer to go ahead and do a quick check. So now it's going to go ahead and say, okay, great. Before I just went over that ZenApp server, there were no packages for XML and Notepad. What I'm going to go ahead and do is just force it to go ahead and push it over right away. So we'll wait for this pop-up to come up, and once that's done, we should be ready to go. There we go. So if I flip back over to here and we go to our server, we should see that new application pop up right over there. So all of that from one console, that's part of the goodness that you won't see with anybody else in terms of integration with Microsoft. It's huge because we find more and more that more people want to integrate the product line to make things simpler from a bigger enterprise perspective, to be able to delegate administration and be able to do this from a simpler UI. So the same process occurs. I've done that over there. I could go to my iPad, log in, application appears via receiver, and I'm connected. So pretty simple. Makes sense to most of you guys? It's an option. It's a design choice you have. If you're in that case where you have to work with different teams, you need to figure out how to deliver apps to those servers, this is a tool that you can use from your Swiss Army knife. All right, let's jump back over to the presentation real quick, which is on this one, which is B. Nope, not yet. Give me one more second. We'll get this right today, I'm sure. Nope. One second. BG, oh, two. That's what it is. Sorry about that. Tell me to build an infrastructure. I can do it all day long. Tell me to figure out video equipment. I can't do it. All right. So, video guy, I think I'm going to need your help, man. This one is going to be a little confusing for me. There we go. Two. See, I thought that said C. There we go. Nope. That's it. Thanks. Appreciate it. Round of applause for the video guy. Thank you. Can't do my job without him. All right. Design number three, VM hosted app access. Another great idea that's part of version 7 that a lot of people have never seen before. What are some of the use case scenarios for? Well, it's pretty simple. You have applications that are incompatible or not supported by RDS. What do I call those? Craplications. They suck, right? Someone paid $5 for someone to write an app and you expect to use it in production. That's a craplication. I had a real nice graphic of one of the guys from Star Wars doing something that made it look like a craplication, but I don't have it up here. If you have apps that are really picky and they need a USB device, they have a serial cable connection, they have something that requires some funky peripheral of some weird sort, don't know what it is, there's another way you can do VM-hosted applications. Biometric devices are some of those because they're not particularly multi-user aware applications. Or if you have apps that just plain Jane don't work and need to run a single user environment, that's a scenario for VM-hosted apps. So let's go right to a demo and let's see what that looks like. So we're going to flip back over to B. Perfect. All right. And let's go and see what that looks like. So I want to log in and I want to see what that experience is like. I'm going to log into Storefront and let's see what applications I have access to. Now, I've already done some of the work. I've gone through, created a desktop, created a catalog, mirrored them together. But what I did that's a little bit different is I didn't publish it normally. So let me show you what that looks like. I go back to my controller here, and you can see if I go into my groups, I have applications nodes. This is the point where I start to publish applications like I would if I was a ZenApp administrator. I already have some of these defined. I have XML Notepad. But if I wanted to go through that process of creating one, that's basically how I would create a local application. I'd select Next. I'd select a group to append it to. And I select a path of an application if I wanted to use this application in a reverse fashion, which is something we'll get into later. So let's show you what that looks like. In that design, I actually had one already created. So I'll log in here as myself. And if the demo gods are with me, we should see a series of applications and desktops here from Storefront. XML Notepad is an app. It's an app vSequence package that I already delivered that runs and executes on a Windows 7 client operating system, but it's going to look a little bit different than you would from a VDI perspective. So we'll attempt to launch this and see what happens. What's going to happen is it's going to show you a Windows 7 background, but it's going to change. And what will happen is the actual parent application I want to use, which is XML Notepad, will take over the screen and show me the whole UI of that application. Now, this is an appy app. Again, I sequenced it, push it to my individual VM already from the controller, and there it appears. So that application, in terms of VM hosted apps, is a scenario where if you have these crap applications, you got to get them working. It's a one-off situation. That's how you would solve that problem. Okay, your question was, is that regardless of what? It could have been Windows 7, it could have been Windows 2008 R2. It just depends. Yeah. So it can support a variety of different operating systems. Okay, so let's go back to the presentation. So let's go to back to input B. We'll flip back. And we'll continue. Another design. Next one. App v5 hosted app integration. How many of you use App V in production currently today? Guess what? So do we at Citrix. We use App V as well. So one of the things, if you have time and you're curious about what we're also working on at Citrix IT, we're doing a lot of initiatives with Microsoft. Take some time, go back and look at the Tech Ed presentation from 3 months ago, June timeframe for Tech Ed North America. There's a really good session that these guys did from Citrix IT that'll really help you understand bigger ways of deploying App V applications. So what if we want to do it from Studio? This is also interesting because Studio now fully supports App v5 from within the UI. If you're a current Citrix customer and you're using old school CAS or Citrix application streaming, unfortunately, we do not support that from within the GUI UI perspective. Not available. If you want to publish it, the old school RAID run command path utility process, you can do that. But from here on out, we use App v5 as a de facto standard for app streaming within the UI. It's pretty simple, so let's go in over the architecture and how we integrate with it. Everything is done from the studio. So whether you're going to publish the apps from whether it's hosted apps or whatever you have you, it's all done through studio. And studio leverages the App SDK. So this is where we start to get really super technical in terms of where we get into some intricacies and how these all work. We can't publish the App V apps without having a connection to the App V infrastructure. So there's a requirement here. If you already have the App V server in place, your management server is available, we can directly make a connection into that via PowerShell and then enumerate all those applications from the UI for users. All of this happens behind the scenes. So when you've actually created your console extension and you've extended it to integrate to the App V infrastructure, you have the ability to publish apps directly. So how does it work from a studio perspective? We go to the studio. We then actually send our App V package information via an App ID and GUID directly to the VDA. Now the VDA is just sitting there. He's listening. He's saying, hey, give me any apps you send from the console. I'll enumerate them. I'll make them execute in the user's environment. After all that process, the user goes through, launches the application, and the client then does any synchronization it needs to for downloading any additional bits of the sequence package. So all that's done seamlessly behind the scenes without the user interfacing or having to do any of that. In the UI, this is what it looks like. You have your ports, you have your publishing server and management server already defined here. Once this is done, it's pretty simple. There's a couple other things you have to do via PowerShell, enable PS remoting and so forth, and trusted execution. Those are probably the biggest things, but you have the ability to publish apps directly right from here into the user's desktop. What's nice is once they're published, you can either launch them one of three ways. You can launch them right from the start menu, you can launch them from the receiver, you can launch them a variety of ways depending on what sort of file type association you have set up in terms of how they're published. Now, once you have that done, the apps appear, the icons appear, but what you can't do, if you're familiar with the old school thing called the App Feed Conduit, which was a really, really old tool that we had, that is gone. That's an old way that old Zen App administrators would publish the conduit connection to an API package, so you can't do that anymore. You have to use Studio, you have to do it via PowerShell in order to make that application appear. If you have FTA set up and there are file extensions for that particular app, like Excel, XLS, or something like that, when the user clicks on that file, it'll automatically understand that and launch the correct application for that. So let's go through and see what that looks like again from a demo. We'll flip over to this device again. Okay. So we'll go to my controller here. And what I want to do is I'll create an application. Go through next. I'll select my group that I want to deliver to. In this case, it'll be 2008R2. And at this point, it's querying the VDA. It's going to say, OK, tell me every app you have on there. And also, tell me every app that the AppV server has available for me. So whether it's natively installed, or it's an empty operating system, or you have the AppV packages somewhere on the AppV file server on the share, we're going to be able to query them from the virtual agent via PowerShell and bring those into the UI. So let's say I want to select this one down here as an example. There's a 64-bit AppV app. I'll select finish, and I'll assign that to that group. Pretty much that's it. I've already done the hard work here because I already have my API publishing defined at this level of my architecture. So once that's done, and you have the virtual agent installed in the master image, everything else can enumerate. So if you use API in production, you can use it now from the studio without having to do any extra work. All right, that takes care of that one. Let's go back to our PowerPoint. Good. Local app access. Who's heard of this one? This is one of the last ones. This is a best kept secret, one of the ones I think is the coolest function you can use if you have a use case for it. What does it allow you to do? Let's say you have a really, really, really challenging thing. And let's say you have a bunch of applications that are in your master image, whether it's Server 2008R2, Windows Server 2012, or what have you. But you've run across a problem. You figured out that you need access to an app that's here, living on this endpoint you logged in from. With local app access, I can reverse a connection from my virtual desktop through the protocol into my physical machine and launch an application. So this is a use case that's not really common, but a lot of people get to this point where, hey, you know, I've got this old macro from Excel that I can't run in Excel 2013. It's got to run in Excel 2007, the developer's gone. It's a crap application. How do I make that work without having to go through all the process of having to build a bunch of VMs and so forth or RDS servers because it just isn't going to work? Let's show you how that happens. So we'll flip back over to here. There we are. Now this is my demo machine. So let's show you what I've got installed on here. If you take a look, we've got Office 2007 natively installed on this physical endpoint in front of me. What I'm going to do is make a connection over to my virtual desktops. Let's say, for example, Server 2012. I've got a pool of those already, and I want to see how this works. What's going to happen is he's going to do a couple checks against my machine. He's going to say, hey, you know what? Do you have the right version of the receiver on, which we do? And also, do you have a certain group policy applied that says I'm allowed to remote certain applications? And if all of those are true, and if it makes sense, then when I logged in and I have my desktop, what will happen is that I'll have some icons that will appear directly on my desktop. So we'll give this a second here. My laptop is just a little bit slow in logging in with this VM, but you'll see a bunch of icons appear right here in just a sec. There we go. So Excel 2007 appeared. But just to prove, again, that it is a local app access, we'll do the same thing here. We'll take a peek at what we have running. So control panel on my server 2012 shows that I have Office 2013, but yet I have Excel 2007 here. So let's see, how does that work? That then punched a connection from my virtual all the way to my physical, but the cool thing is I can even open local documents that are on my physical machine. Pretty cool? So I suck at Pac-Man, I won't go any further than that. But if you want to challenge me afterwards, let's go over there and we'll have some fun. But that is another design, right? It's another tool. All of these are choices you have if you have Zen Desktop that you don't quite get with anyone else. And they're all designed to solve a particular business pain. So that brings me to the end of my demos. Now we're going to get to some of the cool stuff, tips and tricks. So what if you went through all this process, right, and you published a bunch of apps from AppV, but then you kind of ran into a little bit of a snafu? User calls on the help desk, says, hey, you know what, I'm logged in, it's Jane from accounting, but I have no icons. That doesn't make sense. I've sequenced my package correctly, I've applied appropriate things, I've set to display icon on the user's desktop. How do I make that work if I don't have rights? That's pretty simple. We do it from PowerShell. This is all done directly from the controller, which is a nice thing. You don't have to go and bother your app V guide because your icons didn't appear. Because we're querying the controller and we're using the SDK, we can actually make that connection to restore the user's icons with using a PowerShell script, just like this. So the first thing we do is we enumerate a git broker desktop group. We spit out all the desktop groups you already have created. We then do a git broker machine configuration and say display all app V blobs that I have associated with my app V infrastructure that I see. The last step we do is we actually add the broker machine configuration to say, apply these icons for this group with this UID. Once all of those are done, the icons can be restored to the user's desktop. And you didn't have to even call anybody. You just ran it from PowerShell. So a couple easy tips you can do if you're in a situation where it's, you know, the weekend or your app V guy has gone to Comic-Con and you have no way of getting hold of them. Here's a way you can make that work. The only caveat to this is that we have to remove the icons manually. So the broker can't do it. It's not built within the UI, so you have to use PowerShell to remove them. So that brings us to the last part of what I have. So what's next? What is it that we are working on at Citrix that makes us so unique and special? So some of the things I'll show you are going to be sort of futuristic. They are things that we're looking at, things that we're testing and piloting right now in production. Or I'm sorry, in production, in test, I should say. The first thing we're looking at, of course, is supporting Windows 8.1 and Server 2012 R2. So to show you what that looks like, we'll flip back over to my machine. You should see that on the desktop now. And I'm going to connect to another prototype system that I have here. So it's going to take a minute to spin up. But to show you that we're making progress, again, with the relationship that we have with Microsoft, and seeing as how fast they're releasing Windows, it's never been this fast in all the history, we need to make sure that we are lock and step with them and providing the latest and greatest from our architecture on their architecture. So give me just a second. I typed in my username wrong. And what should happen, if the demo gods are with me, I should enumerate a series of additional desktops. And each of these desktops, of course, are running on Server 2012 R2, not Server 2012 alone. So there's my R2 desktop. That should launch. And that should make a connection here. Give that another second to connect. So this is, again, progress. We're working on this. It's coming. It's not too far away, but these are things that we are working on because we get the inquiries from our customers and Microsoft customers. You've got to have this ready for us. There's our desktop. There's our start menu. So working on it. It's coming. Not too far away. Same thing applies here for Windows 8.1. Once that connects, that should look pretty similar. We'll have the Windows 8.1 start menu appear in the bottom, and that'll also show that we're making progress as well. Same thing here. And this is the part where my mouse kind of gets finicky, but it's 8.1. It's got the nice little beta fish on there, so you can tell it's Windows 8.1. Give me just a sec, we'll get my mouse back. There we go. So progress in terms of what we're working on for the latest and greatest, it's coming. But what else is there? Is there more? Is there anything else that I can share that we're also working on? So obviously, UCentric Receiver is big for us. It's the biggest important thing in terms of what users can use for connecting to a device. I've shown you what it looks like already on an iOS device. You know it's using H.264. You already know that's valid and that that works. But let's see what it looks like if we're going to do a different device. So I'm going to go ahead and switch over now to input A. All right, everyone see that okay? So this is my Surface Pro device. We already have Surface, or Receiver already offers Surface Pro, but there's some things we're working on that are making it a little bit cooler. So I'm going to go ahead and log in, and it's probably going to ask me for some credentials here in a second. So bear with me while I log in. And then once I authenticate, you'll see something that's a little bit different. Give it a second to authenticate. Now, we're going over the cloud, so this is going to take a second for me to go from all the way here from New Zealand all the way to the States. So you can see, again, we've optimized it. It's touch-enabled, just like before, but what's so special about this version? Well, let me show you. Let's open up a page here. In the iOS devices, we support pinch and zoom. Same thing in the upcoming version of Receiver for Windows 8. So this is important because touch, as we mentioned, mobility is the most critical thing that we're working on at Citrix, as well as cloud stuff. But to be able to deliver touch and zoom from a Windows Surface device or Windows touch-enabled device, it's super important to us too. So that's coming. That's the next another one I've got. And the last one I'll show you, we will flip back over to our PowerPoint. Give me just a second. We'll flip over to a B. Great, okay. Also is this device here. Close that app out real quick, and we'll open up DevViewer. Now, in case you didn't know, we already released Receiver for Windows Phone 8 if you're using it. But what's interesting about this one is it works a little bit differently. Super password, you didn't see that. I'll log into my hosted desktop. And my super secret password again. Don't try to hack me, I'm begging you. Yeah, okay, sometimes it doesn't work. Beauty of demos. Effectively, what we have that we can do, that I will try to do it one more time because I'm pretty sure that this works. Oh, bear with me, I know what it is. That's the beauty of when you have too many different demo accounts, man. It gets confusing. So we will put in this super guy's secret password, and this should work. H, one more second. Okay, so we're gonna make a connection over here through the wire all the way to California. Hopefully this works. It should connect, show our application in full Word format. One more second, come on. I saw this is a prototype code, so of course this happens from now on, from time to time, so we'll try one more time. The joy of beta stuff. And I think this time it'll work if we have enough Wi-Fi. Good, there it is. So we can type this way. I've got my full keyboard. I can type slowly but surely, best tech ed ever. But what I can do is turn it sideways. So now we go from portrait to landscape mode. So it could have been an app. It could have been a virtual desktop. It could have been either one of those. So I have the ability in a version that we're working on now to go from this version or the previous version to a version here where we can integrate portrait and landscape. Flip back and forth. There we go. I've got touch enabled right there. So it's the smallest pocket PC you've ever seen. So working on that, that's coming. And that brings us to the end. So I know each of you really care to want this. So this came out of my pocket. I brought this 10,000 miles overseas, so I think this is what you guys really, really want. The knowledge, yeah, that's okay, but somebody really wants a solid-state drive, right? You can be honest. That's what they said in Australia. We just want the solid-state. We're not here for the data. It's all good. So what are we working on? Let me flip back to the PowerPoint so we can get back over to here. Take, come on, one more time. B and take. One more time. Okay, video guy. Save me again. I'm begging you. 2B take. I'm telling you about these are confusing. Super confusing. All right. Of course, obviously, things to take away. Support for Windows 7, Windows 8, 8.1, 2012, R2, System Center 2012, and all its future releases we will support. AppVify Publishing, if you are using AppV, I highly recommend you test drive this. Please try it in your environment. Let us know how it works. It's really simple. We have documentation that walks you through how to do it step by step. Most important thing of all, no matter what any vendor says, one size does not fit all. There is no magic lighting. There is no magic solution for every user problem you're going to face. You have to choose the right architecture. And only Zen Desktop gives you all these choices. That's a fact. Nobody else does. So who wants this? Are you ready? I'm going to pick two people at random. And normally I just give this away, but I'm going to make you work for it. But it'll be fun. Trust me. You'll like it. It'll be fun. So I'll pick two people. Who wants this? Raise your hand. All right. I'm going to pick the guy in the black shirt all the way in the back, standing against the wall. You've been standing for a long time. Come on up here. And I'm going to look over here on this side. Anyone else over here that wants it? All right, I'm going to pick you right here in the gray shirt. Come on up. So because you're good sports, you get a USB drive also. And I've got one for you. It's slightly used, though. I had to put my PowerPoint on it, but it's okay. You'll like it. You'll like it. So come on up here. Are you ready? This is where it gets really fun, really, really interesting. Give them just another minute to get up. We're going to play this game. And it's only going to take a minute. But it's simple. It's really simple. I've made this game so simple that we can do it in under a minute. All right? Here's how we're going to do it. You know how to play rock, paper, scissors? Do you know how to play rock, paper, scissors? All right. It's very simple. The audience, you guys are going to be my judges. All right? So keep an eye on these guys. Make sure they don't cheat. All right? What you can't do, if you look at all of these answers to rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock, you cannot use the same gesture twice. All right? You can't. So we only have a few minutes left to go through this. So I'm going to count like this. One, two, three. When I hit three, you make your sign. Okay? You guys tell me who wins following the diagram. Ready? Here we go. It's like the All Blacks, you know, versus the Canadians again. We know who's going to win, right? All right. Ready? Get your hand out. Are you ready to go? One, two, three. So you had scissors. Okay, and so tell me out, help me out, guys. Who wins, scissors over Spock crushes lizard or scissor? You did scissors. Scissors wins. Congratulations. There you go. I got you a USB drive too. So, cheers. All right, thanks, guys. Any other questions you have? Please fill out feedback. I came 10,000 miles over here. I really appreciate you. Let me know how well, how bad I did. If you like the demos, if you need more demos, and here's additional resources and related content. There's a session tomorrow if you're interested in scalability, something I do all day, night, and long. I breathe, eat, sleep it. If you want to know how it scales in real life production, come tomorrow. I'll show you all the data I've got around scalability. Thanks, guys.